This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Thanks for listening. Stay with us for the next half hour. We'll have a look at the chilling effect that President Trump's policies on immigration may be having on one peacebuilding program at EMU. It usually attracts lots of international students. I also am going to share with you our submission this year to the Virginia Association of Broadcasters for Outstanding News Series. It's a compilation, a medley, if you will, of last year's series on refugees in Virginia. And we'll also hear the story of Peyton Skipwith. He was an enslaved African-American man who helped build the University of Virginia nearly 200 years ago. He finally got his name on a building last week. We'll have his story. But first, it's billed as a week of innovation and art, with Charlottesville itself as the canvas. The 6th annual TomTom Founders Festival is wrapping up today in Charlottesville. WMRA's Marguerite Gallerini has this review.
Paul Beyer, the festival's founder, can definitely provide what you might call the elevator pitch for the event.
So, TomTom's a time when I think Charlottesville really shines. We like to celebrate our local entrepreneurs, our local founders, our local civic leaders, and we also try to invite the nation, increasingly the nation, to come to Charlottesville and check out what's going on here. There will be 300 speakers at TomTom this year, 60 bands, 65 venues, over 150 events, many of them, like tonight, completely free.
And what do all these events have in common? Associate Director Celia Castleman explains.
The goal is to connect collaborators with one another and to leave legacies. So the collaborations that people find amongst each other and make and discover will then turn into something sustainable. We love the idea of having speakers come and really spend time with our community.
This year, some of those speakers include New York Times Chief White House Correspondent Peter Baker, U.S. Senator Mark Warner, co-founder and CEO of Code 2040 Laura Widman Powers, and many others from the arts, science, and the environment. Two keywords that capture the essence of TomTom: community and innovation. Steve Plascon attended a session called Innovation in Education on Tuesday night.
Being an associate professor in the Curry School, I'm really interested in educational innovation. So I hope to get out of this just some sense of what the youth of America are doing right now, what's happening locally. I hope to be energized by this.
Kristen Jameson, assistant professor of teaching at UVA and director of the Loop Center for Social and Emotional Development, emphasized the need for more engaging education.
If the instruction is not engaging and creative, it doesn't involve movement, if it doesn't involve entry, then a lot of time is lost and wasted. And so really it's about merging the idea of quality with engagement and interest.
To get younger attendees engaged, TomTom showcases workshops, including one featuring secrets from the art of puppetry. It was staged at the Paramount Theater by Graham Black Robinson and Michelle Urbano from the Mermaid Theater of Nova Scotia.
On Monday, he ate through one apple.
It's great for us to not only get the kids to see a professional puppetry at a young age, but for them to actually get their hands on the puppets and to realize that it's basically playing with toys. It's a really great sort of hands-on experience with theater that they get to have at a young age.
My turn.
All of this creativity and invention require fuel, so food is another important feature. Many of the city's local restaurants are participating in the Farm-to-Table Restaurant Week, during which they highlight a local ingredient. Citizen Burger Bar decided to highlight more than one.
This year we're doing one called the Hometown Burger. So we're using local cheese from Mountain View Farm, and then mushrooms are out in Nelson County from AM Fog Mushrooms. And our beef is 5 miles down the road from Timber Creek Farm. It's grass-fed, grass-finished.
That's the venue's general manager, Kate Elwood, who's also attending some of the music events.
I plan on going to Porchella in Belmont for all of the music acts, so that sounds really fun.
Conveniently, the festival's website has a 72-hour weekend itinerary for those who could not attend the weekdays. For WMRA News, I am Marguerite Gallerini.
And it's not over yet. The TomTom Festival wraps up tonight with Porchella. That's the event that Kate Elwood just mentioned. It's the Front Porch Concert Series throughout the Belmont neighborhood. And there's also a craft cocktail competition going on this evening and more. So if you have a chance, check it out. Now, on a more serious note, NPR reported recently that President Trump's travel ban is having a chilling effect on international student enrollment at universities across the country. In Harrisonburg, that may also be true when it comes to potential participants in peacebuilding coursework. WMRA's Christopher Clymer-Kurtz reports.
Deka, she asked that I not use her last name, is a Somali humanitarian worker focused on empowering girls to play greater leadership roles. In the context of Somalia's deepening drought that has left millions of people facing an acute food shortage, she also helps to identify duplication and gaps in humanitarian response efforts. This summer wouldn't have been Deka's first trip to Harrisonburg for peace training, but earlier this year, Somalia was named in both travel ban executive orders.
Myself, I'm affected because for my own professional development and building my capacity to do my work, even for my own personal well-being. Like, for example, the course I was coming was specific to my own personal well-being and people around me.
She had hoped this year to attend Strategies for Trauma Awareness and Resistance training. The course is part of the Eastern Mennonite University Center for Justice and Peacebuilding's Summer Peacebuilding Institute, or SPI, which offers 5 sessions of various courses that develop skills of resilience in the context of natural hazards, political instability, violence, and terrorism, finding unique ways to analyze and respond to oppression, organizing and resolving conflicts in communities that are fractured and polarized, and more. Deka said that incurring the cost of getting a visa, which for a Somali requires 2 separate trips into Kenya or Djibouti, was simply too much of a gamble this year. That's because even though the travel ban is on hold due to multiple court challenges, its confusing fallout casts doubt on whether or not she actually would have been able to get to SPI, even if she would have been able to obtain a visa.
It was concerns that I had on what's going to happen. It's quite uncertain because now it's on hold. It's not completely stopped. So you don't know tomorrow whether another executive order will come out. And then you will be affected by that order, by that ban again. So that's the confusion that I had.
Nationwide, 38% of U.S. universities say that their international enrollment is down. At EMU, SPI's director Bill Goldberg is feeling the chill.
We usually get people at the Summer Peacebuilding Institute from several of the countries that were on the travel bans. People from Iraq, people from Iran, Syria, Somalia, Sudan. These are the places around the world where there's a lot of violent conflict, and the people who are coming here to get the skills to help decrease that conflict.
International applications to SPI are 20% lower this year, Goldberg says. That's at least in part because of the ban, as in Deka's situation, but it's also because of fear of the broader climate.
There's a woman from Kenya who was planning on coming here and taking our course on violent extremism and getting some work on trauma and on mediation. Her goal was to go back home and negotiate between Al-Shabaab and try and get them to be less violent. Her stated reason for not even applying for a visa to come to the U.S. was that she was afraid of how she would be treated in the U.S. So this is a woman who's willing to negotiate with what we consider a terrorism group in Kenya, but she's afraid to come to Harrisonburg because she's afraid of how she'll be treated in customs in the airport. If she gets a visa, maybe she'll be denied upon entry just because she's, you know, from Kenya.
The enrollment downturn is also affecting SPI's finances, Goldberg says. And while a last-minute uptick in domestic applications could improve the program's overall numbers this year, the reduction in international applicants also takes an emotional toll. People whom SPI staff know and who are risking their lives even to improve difficult situations in their home countries can't or are afraid to come to the U.S.
These are not people scamming their way into the country. These are people whose stated goal for my program and for the other programs at the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding are to come, get peacebuilding skills, go home and use them in their community to make their communities better and safer places. And they're being stopped.
For Deka in Somalia, the ban doesn't make sense.
It's counterproductive in the sense that the people who are trying to do something about the problems in that country are being affected by that ban, that they can't come here to develop themselves and then go back to their own countries to do something about the issues they're having.
Her work continues. As for attending the SPI course, she says maybe next time. For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
On Thursday, more than 100 people gathered outside a two-story brick office building on the University of Virginia's grounds. There, in an hour-long ceremony, a plaque was unveiled dedicating the building to Peyton Skipwith, an enslaved African-American man who helped build the school nearly 200 years ago. WMRA's Jordy Yeager was there.
The dedication was led by UVA's President's Commission on Slavery. Dr. Marcus Martin is the commission's co-chair.
As we all know, the enslaved played vital roles in UVA's history, such as Peyton Skipwith's contributions as a master mason, quarrying stone for use in construction of the university, right back here, just behind us.
In 2013, UVA formed the commission to study, document, and memorialize the lives of the hundreds of enslaved men, women, and children who helped build and maintain UVA, but who have largely been unacknowledged since its founding. 2 years ago, a new student dorm was named after William and Isabella Gibbons, two locally prominent African Americans who were enslaved by UVA professors. At Thursday's dedication, Carol Malone addressed the large crowd, her eyes tearing up as she looked out over more than two dozen family members, fellow descendants of the Skipwith family line, some coming from as far away as Ohio.
I have envisioned this moment many times. I'm so happy to see you, and I'm so happy to be with you. Let's make an effort to stay connected. Peyton Skipwith and his family spirit brought us together. Let's continue to build upon his legacy. Thank you.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
And now, a blast from the not-too-long-ago past, a little over a year ago, and WMRA's groundbreaking series on refugees in Virginia. Of course, we don't have time for the whole thing. It was a 14-part series. But here are some highlights. Specifically, these are the excerpts that we have submitted to the Virginia Association of Broadcasters for Outstanding News Series in 2016. We'll get the results in a couple months, so keep your fingers crossed. Here's our first part. Even if high school was a great time for you, there were certainly times when you felt a little lost or left out. Imagine going to high school in another country with another language and another culture. Oh, and you may also be carrying trauma from some horrific things you witnessed in your home country. WMRA's Jesse Nadler has the story of one Harrisonburg high school program that pairs refugee students with others who have been there.
Guess what is the second most common foreign language behind Spanish spoken at Harrisonburg City Schools? Give up? It's Arabic. 11% of students come from Arab-speaking homes. Harrisonburg's school system is really where you see the city's status as an immigration hub come to life. More than one out of every three students are identified as limited English speakers. Within that population, kids come from 47 different countries with more than 48 languages spoken. Behind the U.S., the majority of students are born in Iraq and Honduras.
Since I was a kid, there was war there in Baghdad. It was like really big war.
This is Ali. He's 19 and from Iraq. Ali's father was granted asylum to come to the United States, but he had to leave his family behind. Ali says he was shot at when it was discovered his father had gone to the U.S. Laura Feistinger McGrath takes me into an office and flips through a stack of files of new students to the high school.
I have students who are as young as 11 and 12 who have helped their parents with mortgages. Like, I have no idea how these kids are negotiating that, which is interesting because then we throw them a multiple choice test and say that they're not successful. But the reality is they're negotiating real life, meaningful experiences.
To help refugee students integrate into the high school, a pilot program called Peer Leaders was launched last year using funding from the Harrisonburg Refugee Resettlement Office. It's a mentoring program in which new students are paired with students who were themselves refugees. Peer leaders are given 3 days of training in basic counseling, how to be an active listener, how to ask questions, and crucially, when to refer a problem to an adult.
When I came here, I was really scary. I didn't know what to do. I don't know the language. I don't know anyone.
One day, a Kurdish girl approached Ali in the hallway and asked him in Arabic if he was all right. It was a small gesture that meant a lot, to know that someone from his culture was looking out for him. He joined peer leaders so he could repeat this kindness to incoming Arab students.
There's a couple when they came here. I took them like to classes. I told them some of the rules. I told them like they need help with the teacher, with the counselor, with anything. I'm here to help.
These are teenagers. It can be difficult to get them to commit to a mentorship program on top of everything else they're dealing with.
They don't know how to articulate all the time what their issues are.
And then they don't always realize, adults don't always realize, the extreme issues that might be happening in a high school.
It's easy to assume that the stream of refugees at Harrisonburg High is the result of the current global migration crisis. But the demographics have been like this for 15 years. The countries of strife may have changed, but the human beings seeking refuge do not. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
Those who come here seeking asylum from violence in other countries often suffer from years of poor or even non-existent medical care. In the next installment of our series on refugees in Virginia, WMRA's Jordy Yeager introduces us to one such patient and the doctors at the University of Virginia who focus on the special needs of asylum seekers.
Still I'm alive because of the help and the generosity of the American people and the American government. Otherwise, I would have died had I not come here.
56-year-old Bimal Chetri isn't exaggerating. In all likelihood, he really would be dead if he hadn't come to Charlottesville as a refugee 2 years ago. Chetri is one of more than 3,000 refugees who've moved to Charlottesville through the International Rescue Committee since 1998. When they arrive, the IRC directs refugees to the health department, where they get rescreened and receive the vaccinations required by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They're enrolled in Medicaid and referred to UVA for their health needs.
I'm Fern Houck. I'm a physician at the University of Virginia in the Department of Family Medicine.
When Dr. Houck moved here 15 years ago, refugees had to bounce all over UVA and sometimes all over town to get the care they needed. Imagine doing that in a foreign country where you don't speak or read the language. When Dr. Houck saw this, she collaborated with the IRC and the health department and created the International Family Medicine Clinic at UVA.
Basically, we agreed that we would be the primary care physicians for all the refugees who come through the IRC into Charlottesville. The thing that's unique about our program is that we don't have a separate refugee clinic. It's incorporated into our family medicine clinic at the primary care center here.
Now, this may seem trivial, but by incorporating refugees into the everyday American experience of going to see a doctor, one significant border in a country filled with linguistic, social, and cultural barriers is crossed. The International Family Medicine Clinic has more than 2,000 refugee patients. At their initial visit, Houck and her colleagues use an in-person interpreter to explain what a family physician is. Then they try to create a medical history for the patient.
We've also worked very hard on the mental health side. We've talked about people coming from war-torn areas, being displaced from their homes, seeing people killed in front of their very eyes. Sorry.
Dr. Houck chokes up when she thinks about the trauma some of her patients have suffered. Some female refugees have been raped or been victims of genital mutilation. Others have been physically tortured. There's no easy way to raise such traumatic and horrific events, but from a medical perspective, they need to. Studies show that depression and post-traumatic stress disorder are more common among refugees than average Americans, and if left untreated, can lead to suicide. Houck's been invited to refugee weddings and adopted as an honorary family member. But perhaps the greatest joy is the prospect of seeing former patients return, not as patients, but as practitioners.
I have one who I just heard about from her mom that she just graduated this past year from dental school in Richmond. So that's pretty incredible. I want them to come back here and practice.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
For refugees trying to establish themselves in a strange land, just like for the rest of us, reliable transportation can be the key to landing a job or simply being independent. One Harrisonburg bicycling enthusiast is not only teaching refugees how to ride bikes, she is also providing them with their own bicycles. WMRA's Christopher Clymer-Kurtz attended the most recent class and has this report.
The morning is not without incident. A crowd of about 10 volunteers and even more refugees from all over the world, Cuba, Pakistan, Congo, are gathered in a church parking lot to learn some tips for riding bicycle in America.
So use your back brake a little more and you'll skid rather than flipping.
There you go.
The best part? At the end of the 2 hours, the bikes they're using during the lesson will be theirs to keep. Last fall, Harrisonburg resident Richie Vaughn met with a group of women from Iraq to garner feedback about the city's bus system, sidewalks, and related infrastructure.
So just sort of offhand, I said, well, do any of you ride a bike? Because I can get across town in 20 minutes on a bike, and you're saying it takes an hour on a bus. And a bunch of them kind of like, you know, giggled and put their heads down. And it turns out that in Iraq, it's actually not socially, culturally acceptable to ride a bike if you're a woman. And several of them expressed interest in learning how to ride a bike, sort of for self-empowerment and this sort of new thing that you can do in America.
One of the 15 bicycle recipients at this recent class is Fareed Ahmed, a college computer lecturer from Karachi City in Pakistan, where he faced religious persecution. Just 2 months ago, after 3 years in Sri Lanka, he arrived in the United States. He's looking for work and says that not having a job leaves him bored at home.
Now I have bicycle, so I will use it. So it's very helpful for me to travel, especially to little nearest places.
The first part of the class is fitting helmets, here with volunteer Phoebe Kirby-Gletkowski.
Too tight now? Sorry, okay, we can make it looser.
Vaughn introduces the instructor for the day, Matt Hassman of Safe Routes to School.
Matt is going to teach us basic laws and rules here, and then we will go practice in the street with cars.
This drill will be to practice stopping quickly. Practice using both brakes so you don't go forward over the bars when you stop.
After the lesson, everyone divides into smaller language-specific clusters with an instructor and interpreter for each group, and they ride out onto the streets through a residential area of town. The bicycle Ahmed receives isn't one of the brand new ones and is without a hoped-for rack for carrying supplies. Nonetheless, he is pleased that he again has his own bicycle.
I had my bicycle in Sri Lanka, so I donate to some other refugees. They can use it. I donate there and God arranged for me here. So I am happy.
For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Graney, Klein May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Pam and Jim Huggins, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg in Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom at WMRA.org, and be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio, and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host, so I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.